I'm Ed the Sock, and this is FU Politics on Fun, the FU Network, powered by your support on Patreon.com, P-A-T-R-E-O-N, Patreon.com/FU Network TV, and through PayPal at FUNetworkTV@gmail.com. Drop us a few bucks. Don't be a freeloader. And now, here's your show.
Now, let's listen.
This is another episode of the Broken Clock Podcast. Almost said it wrong again, which people on Twitch find very funny. I am Leanna Kersner with my partner in crime, Mouse Mary Jest. And Mouse and I were talking over the last week, and Mouse has very, very strong feelings on a particular equation. No, we are not going to talk about math. We are going to talk about critical race theory, which has come up in the popular consciousness now, through the 1619 Project, through the New York Times, which is now being taught in schools. Mm-hmm. Now, what is critical race theory? This is a very, very difficult thing to explain because, like much of postmodern thought, it is many things. It is also nothing specific, except it comes around a central principle. And this is what we're going to focus on, because I know Mouse has very strong feelings about this. The idea is that systems are behind racism. So even though someone themselves may not be racist, by participating in a system, they are perpetuating racism. And at the core of this is the definition of racism that has come up in fairly recent years that is prejudice plus institutional power. It's otherwise known as the Bayh-Dole equation. And Mouse, I'm going to hand the floor over to you because you have written on this. You have very strong feelings on this. And you are Latino. You are Hispanic. It's weird because in reading some studies on this, I actually came across academics using the word Chicano, which is odd. So I'm going to leave this open to you. What are your thoughts, because we deal in thoughts and not feelings here, right, on the prejudice plus power equation?
Well, a very, very, very brief background of where this comes from. You, of course, many people who have been in discussions and debates on the internet probably have heard the notion that you cannot actually be racist if you are a member of a minority because of the equation, the Bayh-Dole equation, that equates racism as the combination of prejudice and power. This equation first appeared in the 1970, I believe it was 1970, book by Pat Bayh-Dole called Developing New Perspectives on Race, which set one of the modern tenets of social justice theory, rhetoric.
Yeah, and this was in response to the existing modality, which was what they're calling colorblind race, racialized society. You're colorblind. It's been used on selective teachings of Dr. Martin Luther King, among others, mm-hmm. correct? Okay, right. So this is replacing the idea that a man should be judged by the content of his character, not the color of his skin.
Right.
Right.
And so this has given rise to, of course, the notion that, for example, taking my background, that you could say that Hispanic or Latin people cannot be racist because we do not have the institutional power to carry out racist policy. Now, the problem with the Bayh-Dole equation, and I can understand what Bayh-Dole was trying to do here, but the problem is this. It creates this new definition whereby you divorce the moral principle from the action. For example, it is like saying pedophilia. For example, a person is not a pedophile if, you could say, he knows that he has the urge to molest a child, but does not have the opportunity to do so.
That just seems like, the longer that situation goes on, the more risk happens there.
Yes. Well, and the problem is this. The Biddle equation was created to address these issues of race and institutionalized racism.
Which I think we agree. I mean, I shouldn't assume. Do you agree that institutionalized racism is a thing?
Oh, hell yes.
Like, okay, good. Yeah.
Recently, an African-American swimmer who was part of a swimming team, I believe it was a college swimming team, was on tour in the bus. They were traveling back. I do not remember the exact details, just the general shape of the story. I read it a couple of days ago. He got off to go to the bathroom, and the police officers tackled him and assaulted him because they were operating under the impression that he, the only Black member of the swimming team, was hijacking the bus.
Now, this is a story that repeats itself frequently across American history. I mean, there's a story, and this is where I start. This is where I start questioning Biddle's equation, because the awful story of Emmett Till, who was beaten to death for either looking at a white woman or talking to a white woman, because he was from, I believe it was Chicago. He was from the city anyway, where the power dynamics between Blacks and whites were not as rigid and zero sum as the Jim Crow South. And so just by traveling to a different state, he encountered a totally different power structure, and he ended up losing his life. And it became this big thing because his mother decided to allow photos of his beaten body in his casket at his funeral to go national, and it created a real public outcry.
Yeah.
The Emmett Till story, to me, is an example of how you cannot sum racism up neatly as prejudice plus power. Because, Till, just by going into the South, lost his power. The white people who beat him up, who I don't think they would see themselves as powerful people, still were empowered by racist lawmakers who, even though certain things weren't illegal on the books, were turning a blind eye.
Right. And like I said, I can understand what Biddle was trying to get at. Biddle was trying to target the notion of institutionalized racism, which is a thing. But unfortunately, the side effect of this equation is that not only did the argument start tackling institutionalized racism, but the more that the equation has been introduced, it has been in many ways trying to morph the notion of non-institutionalized racism, and by that I mean it is touching the notion of racism as falls in the personal sphere, and the personal sphere is a moral sphere.
Right.
If we go and say, that I am a minority, therefore it is incapable for me to be racist, and instead you use a different term. You're not racist, you're prejudiced.
Right.
It is creating a different standard. It is creating a kind of a separate but equal standard in the stance of moral logic, and it is actually kind of a little bit condescending, because you're saying, well, poor little you, you don't have the power, so you're not capable of doing as much harm as these other empowered people. But that's missing the point altogether.
Yeah, that sounds an awful lot like the original justifications of natural law to justify slavery and also not giving women the right to vote or hold office or anything like that.
Right. And to assume that only the powerful, and by powerful you mean societally empowered, politically empowered, can create an impact. Not only they can create an impact is very, very naive and simplistic. Power doesn't alter the nature of or rightness of someone's belief merely because of the range of impact. And the problem with Biddle's equation is that it lessens the moral guilt of individuals who embrace bigoted beliefs.
Right.
just because they're considered a powerless minority. And the problem with that is that that does not solve the problem of racism. It, in fact, in many ways, it encourages the existence of racist ideas to continue just as long as they do so in the shape of a minority. And as a Hispanic man, I can tell you, Hispanic people can be just as racist, just as bigoted as white people. When I was in Houston, when my mother was dying, we were being driven around by a fellow Ecuadorian. Mm-hmm. And I was aghast because it's really, really, he was telling me, and of course I was, this felt like I was in the middle of a Twilight Zone episode, because he said, oh no, he was going to be voting for Trump because he didn't want those, and I'm not going to repeat some of the things that he said.
Right.
These were very, very racially charged words.
Right.
Targeted at Hispanic immigrants of a certain ancestral descent.
While you guys were in the car.
While we were in the car, so I couldn't quite walk away.
That would be what critical race theory considers a microaggression.
Right.
Right.
And of course, I couldn't. My first instinct was, of course, to get out of the car. But
right.
This is the driver who was taking my mother for a CT scan. So I couldn't quite do that. I did file a complaint with the company, but this was a Hispanic man,
right,
who was being incredibly prejudiced, for incredibly racist against other Hispanics. And
which is true of most large racial groups, that they don't like each other.
Yeah, well, and you know, within the ginormous flag of, you know, the Hispanic community, you have, like you said, you have people with Chicano descent. So you have people
For people who don't know what Chicano means, it means people of Mexican descent.
Right.
Right.
And of course, in Ecuador, for example, an insult is cholo.
Yes.
Which it means a person of indigenous or partly indigenous ancestry. That's the level of racism we're talking here. I have indigenous ancestry in my background. But again, my family is kind of like this gigantic ceviche cocktail of ancestry, because I have Roma, I have indigenous, I have black. My uncle Adalberto Ortiz was a very, very important writer in for the black voices in Latin America. So my family is kind of like an exception in many ways, because instead of following the trend of a lot of families in Ecuador of, oh well, no, we only want light-skinned people in our family tree. They were kind of like, come one, come all. The more, the merrier.
So in Ecuador, it's similar to certain like South Asian countries where lighter skin is considered more desirable.
Yes.
Right.
And that is unfortunately a part of a little bit of the Spanish heritage. Families that have bombastic sounding Italian or Spanish last name, like Faidutti or Ferretti or Marquez de la Plata or anything like that, usually pride themselves more on their Spanish or European heritage than their local heritage, which is funny because the majority of them are more mixed than anything else.
And I guess this is where critical race theory gets into the idea of whiteness being a construct that can shift. I mean, the more rational wings of critical race theory cite the fact that at one point the Irish and Italians were not considered white.
White, exactly, yeah.
Which begs the question, take senators, who I think everybody can agree that senators are very powerful people.
Yes.
So if a Hispanic American senator like Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz, whose families both have Cuban roots, in the Bidol equation, in the prejudice plus power equation, are they not powerful because they're Hispanic, or are they no longer Hispanic because they're powerful?
Right, and that's the point at which the at which the equation runs into problems because...
Well, because the equation would say that because of whiteness as a construct, tell me if I'm wrong here, I'm following this. I have an anthropology background. I don't deal with this stuff well. This is all sociology, so I have a real problem with this.
Me too.
Because anthropology tends to be in-group, out-group, where sociology tends to focus on stuff like race as real things. Critical race theory would say that because of their power, Rubio and Cruz have now stepped into whiteness. They are now essentially temporarily white with the privileges that come with that, correct?
Right. And I guess that someone who subscribes to this theory would point towards, I forget his name, dear goodness. As you know, Hedy Lamarr was of Jewish ancestry.
Right.
And her husband was also of Jewish ancestry, but, and to her great chagrin, he became a collaborator with the Nazis as a weapon dealer for them.
See, in critical race theory, that actually isn't a problem because critical race theory does not consider Jews a minority because
right.
Jews are privileged. Jews are essentially white. And one of the big complaints about critical race theory is that it is allowed anti-Semitism to just bloom and thrive on the left because people like Linda Sarsour, and I forget that other person who's a follower of Farrakhan's, say openly anti-Semitic things, but it's okay because they're not white. Therefore, they are prejudiced, not anti-Semitic.
Right, not prejudiced, so, but racist.
Here's my question. If Rubio and Cruz are now temporarily white, the most powerful position in the U.S. government is the president.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So according to critical race theory, was Barack Obama, the first black president, temporarily not black?
It does lend itself to an interpretation like that, doesn't it?
Yeah. Like, according to critical race theory, if minority status is associated with power and whiteness is associated with power, and all of these things are social constructs, meaning the higher up the power chain you get, the whiter you get, either critical race theory is wrong because Barack Obama ascended to the most powerful position in the United States, Clarence Thomas is an incredibly powerful man as a Supreme Court justice.
Mm-hmm.
Either critical race theory is wrong on that grounds because black men were able to ascend and therefore gain power and therefore influence the institutionalized structures, or they stop being black by the very nature of their office. And I think anybody looking at Clarence Thomas and Barack Obama goes, no, that's a black man.
Yeah.
This is the problem I have with it, because it rejects colorblind theory, but it also rejects the idea that race is a real thing. And I wonder what your thoughts are on that, because it is true that the demarcations of race that we follow to this day were actually created to justify things like the slave trade under natural law theory. There were basically what they called savages.
Yes.
Which were most minorities except for the Chinese and mm-hmm. Semites. Then there were the Chinese, who, if I'm recalling properly, were semi-civilized, that they'd had a once great society, but it was now in ruin, according to this theory. This was from back in the days when the Irish weren't white. And then there were Semites, meaning, you know, Middle Eastern people and Jews, who were sort of semi-civilized and not quite white, but if they were useful, well, they could come along until we decide they're no longer useful. Those racial demarcations were kind of arbitrary social constructs, lumping Latinos and black people and all that stuff into a particular group artificially. But we do know the fact that, you know, you can send your DNA away to 23andMe or Ancestry and science can determine where your ancestors came from, that is not social construction. Right?
Right.
Like, somebody can't just say, well, I'm not black anymore because I reject blackness as a social construction. Someone can't stop being black. It's an immutable character. It's an identifiable, immutable characteristic. And that's why it's protected by human rights legislation. So there's another inherent problem with critical race theory here, because human rights, the idea of inalienable human rights, is based on immutable characteristics. Equality is based on the idea that there's certain things about people that don't make them unequal, but they can't change it. If human rights is based on immutable characteristics, and there's no such thing as an immutable characteristic based on race because race is a social construct, human rights start to erode. And I think that's what you're talking about the, if I'm correct, is that where you come from? There's this idea of a second class status, of the fact that, you know, people of color just aren't equally capable of horrible things. Therefore, they're not seen as full people.
It is kind of an infantilizing position, because here's the thing. Well, first of all, concerning the notion of race, of course, as recently many scientists have been more on the side of the equation, saying that racial categories are very weak proxies for genetic diversity, and so that they need to be phased out.
And I admit, I agree with that scientific opinion.
Yeah, I do believe that personally, on my personal philosophy, I do believe there is no difference between us on a fundamental moral, and for me, the moral dimension is the most important one. There is absolutely no difference between any of us, regardless of what we may look like on the outside.
No, our experiences may be very different, but at our core, there are just certain human nature things that are consistent across everybody. They're universal.
Exactly. And because our nature is the same, we are entitled to the same rights and protections, because not because of the fact that we are a minority or a majority,
right,
one race, you know, one quote race or another, but because our metaphysical natures as human beings require certain liberties not to be impeded to us, so that we may be able to exist and thrive. The big issue, I think that the big issue here is that, yes, it does create, this equation does create an infantilizing treatment of people who essentially say, well, you know, you don't have the power, so it's okay for you to be able to believe these terrible, horrible things, because what damage can you do? Really, I mean, it's that kind of condescension. Instead of holding yourself up to a standard that says, you know, no, this is actual racist thought. We who are victims of racism should not be prolonging this same type of belief. And the issue, the central issue in this, I believe, is this, that it is what a certain Russian philosopher called an anti-conceptual mentality.
Yes.
Because we're parceling people out.
Okay, Ayn Rand, everybody drink. There's Ayn our Rand. Ayn Rand drink. Reference for the... she was American, wasn't she? She got citizenship.
Well, she has citizenship. But I wanted to see if anyone would identify it.
I did. Ayn Rand, everybody take a drink.
I forget her last name. But
have they actually officially identified her last name finally?
Her birth name was Alisa... I hope I can pronounce this correctly. Alisa Zinoyevna Rosenbaum.
Ah, okay.
Zinovevna, sorry.
Okay, Zinovevna, yeah.
I have the hardest time with the Russian patronymics, you know, the Evna, Ovnia, etc.
Yeah, I tried to learn how to speak Russian once. It was a disaster.
I went to a Russian conservatory and they gave up on me on trying.
Oh, it's hard. It's hard.
Well,
but, okay, so you have, and I believe this is very Randy, and in the essay you did on this, I'm looking at it right now because I think it's brilliant. You said every human concrete manifestation is the direct result of one or several abstractions that are consciously or unconsciously accepted as truth. Meaning there are just some things we believe as true. Mm-hmm. This is borderline Kantian, but not quite Kantian, because you're saying you have to prove the truth.
Well, yeah, it's the taxonomical creation of concepts.
Right. And so you say, and this is where we become not Kantian, an improperly identified abstraction makes it impossible for a person to correctly identify the nature and origin of concrete manifestations. In order to successfully address an effect, you must be able to properly identify the cause. From there, you will be able to formulate a plan of action that attacks the source instead of merely one of its symptoms. I'm going to jump a paragraph to where you say, Beidel's method truncates the process of abstraction and creates a deformed entity. Epistemically, prejudice is the higher abstraction of which race is a more specific application, and institutionalized racism is the concrete action resulting from that abstraction applied to the world. And that is a really, really smart way of saying Beidel method equals shit be cray cray. It is inverting the two things. It is inverting cause and effect. It is inverting symptom and inherent disease. It is inverting the higher abstraction, prejudice, and the specific application, racism.
Yes. It's misidentifying the source of the issue, and the source of, I'm going to make a very bold claim here, but the source of 90% of humanity's woes is collectivism. And by collectivism, I mean that you essentially embrace a thought pattern by which you divorce the individual and you erase the individual, the merits, the contents of an individual's character,
right,
and instead you judge them solely by their membership or perceived membership in one group or another.
Right.
And so you have this broader category of prejudice, but it manifests itself in more concrete incarnations such as homophobia, sexism, racism, religious intolerance, where basically the core mentality is this person is inferior because they're part of this group. And right, this group is inferior to my group because, and here you will insert an arbitrary notion that is usually not tied to reality. Such right, as, for example, the fact that their race, they're members of this race. And you know, it follows, for example, all black people are stupid, which right, is what many racists believe.
We both get the same stereotype of both, you know, gingers and Latinos are hot-tempered.
That too, yes.
Yeah, more hot-tempered than a regular, normal white person.
Yes.
Yeah, and it's not true. On an individual basis, I've met a lot of people who have those physical characteristics, who are quite calm.
Like Tilda Swinton, who I'm sure is almost reptilian.
Well, yeah. And
I have never seen a person who is just so imperturbable in everything she does as Tilda Swinton.
Yeah, Sonia Sotomayor.
Or Sonia Sotomayor.
Yeah, no one would accuse her of being hot-tempered.
No, she has a demeanor that you could almost say she's almost a Zen master at times.
Yeah. I mean, you know, her and RBG, and they welcomed in, you know, what's his name? Coach Judge, blanking on his name. But after all that scandal, they were just, all right, man, that's not hot-tempered to me. Yeah. And unfortunately, what these stereotypes do is that if somebody, you get stuck, and this is why I come down between thinking there are flaws in colorblind race relations theory and critical race theory. And we need something that's a much more individualized approach, because the problem with colorblind race relations is that invalidates the experience mm-hmm. that comes with being a racialized person.
Right, and it that negates them.
Yeah, that is valid, and that does contribute to somebody's individual identity. And that, you know, that obviously intersects with gender, sexual orientation, gender expression. It's funny because a lot of the black black trans drag queens, I know, which is strange. They allow trans performers now in drag shows. And they kind of had an unfair advantage because they look amazing, but you know, they can wear costumes, the others can't because there's no inserts. Mm-hmm. But that particular group, because they are so intersectionalized, it's almost like they transcend everything.
Right.
And they have become so individualized just based on the daily journey of who they are that they have a lot to teach. Like, they make both both theories fail. Because you can't be colorblind with that, because you're like going, my God, you're black and trans. Your life must have been really, really difficult for you. Because this person also came from Jacksonville, Florida.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Wow.
She was so sweet to talk to. There was a wisdom just based on experience that was amazing. But, you know, colorblind theory should say, well, it doesn't matter that she's black. Well, let's face it, it does.
It does.
Right? It does. In many parts of the world, it still does.
It would be denying it. Here's the thing. You cannot falsify reality.
Exactly.
And you have, and part of reality is acknowledging there are currently shit thoughts, yeah. shit beliefs that are affecting people. Whether they are true or not is not important in this, when you're evaluating a person's experience. If they have been the victim of bad thoughts and bad behavior applied to them, that is a reality you cannot deny.
Right. And that's the problem with colorblind theory, is it's like, I don't see color. Well, then you are risking being very insensitive, because yeah. you're being tone deaf to someone's lived experience. Now, you shouldn't assume someone's lived experience just because they're black or just because they're Latino or Chinese or whatever. But you have to be aware that somebody is not going to interpret certain statements the same way you would. Like, the thing that always tickles me is the difference in charge in the statement, where is your family from, between mm-hmm. Canada and the US?
Yes.
Because Canada, we have this identity as a country of immigrants in a positive way. Mm-hmm. So we just assume nobody's family is from it's white from. People ask other white people, where's your family from? Because they could be Dutch. They could be French. They could be, and we have that whole French Canadian, Anglo Canadian
thing going on. Yeah.
Yeah. And so that does not have the same charge as the US, where people take great offense. And they don't say, where is your family from? Like, we
where are you
say,
from?
Where are you from? Mm-hmm. And that may happen in Canada when you notice a discernible accent. Mm-hmm. Because, like, part of the reason you ask is you don't want to confuse a Persian and an Arab person, and you don't want to confuse a Pakistani and an Indian person. You want to get that right so you don't cause offense. So you just ask.
Right. And, you know, there is... I have noticed that the tactful way that people approach this, they don't say, where are you from? But they go, yeah. I notice an accent. And then they give the person the opening of saying, oh, well, yeah, I'm from Colombia, or, you know,
I've seen that as a microaggression, listed as a microaggression too.
Really?
Yeah. And that's my issue with microaggressions, which is a major part of critical race theory.
Yeah. I mean, here's the thing. They assume maliciousness because you're pointing out that the person has an accent. Does it
assume maliciousness, though? Or does they say intent doesn't matter? That's what I've heard.
That is another thing, too, which honestly, that moves it away, of course, from virtue ethics to deontology, which makes me cringe.
Which we know on this show, we don't like it.
Yeah.
Intents matter.
We literally can't even.
Yeah, we literally can't even always.
Always.
And what we're saying for people who listen to this as sort of layman is we do not subscribe to the theory that if you do something with bad intent, but nothing bad happened, it's okay. Mm-hmm. We don't subscribe to that here.
the ends justify the means is not a thing. The means and the ends must be in accordance with each other.
Yeah, and I think that is a slight tangent. I will get back on it. That is going to be the major historical debate regarding the Trump presidency, mm-hmm. whether the fact that he didn't cause more harm means that he was less awful.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, obviously we're talking about, you know, interestingly enough, you bring up that issue of people and I know Cuban Americans and, you know, Latino Americans or Hispanic Americans who are like, I came here legally. They, some of them support Trump.
I know.
Because they distinguish, of course, you know, you're dealing with this. They're experiencing the idea of otherness. Mm-hmm. So the brown people coming across the border now, they do not see as an in-group. They mm-hmm. see them as some sort of separate entity.
Yes.
And this isn't, what do you think this shows another failure of critical race theory? Because immigration stat or immigration process is the othering factor here, not yes. race.
And the issue, of course, is something that you, that a lot of people that subscribe to this notion. Here's the thing. A lot of older immigrants immigrated and got their citizenship.
Right.
In a time and a decade where it was easier to do so. Just like a lot of people who rally against immigration today, such as Ann Coulter, the Wicked Witch of the West.
Remember I said there was a time that the Irish weren't considered white?
Yes.
We keep going back to that.
To that. Who benefited from more lax immigration laws.
Right.
They're kind of dropping the context, which is something, another thing that, take a shot, because Ayn Rand pointed this out as well. Yeah. Dropping the context is essentially divorcing your argument from philosophical, moral, or historical context, which would actually contradict your argument in order for you to be able to push an agenda through. And, you know, I do believe a lot of Hispanic immigrants who argue, well, I came here legally, are not really aware, because many of them are now citizens and they have mm-hmm. been citizens for 20-30 years, are not as aware of the immigration laws as they exist today as they were back when they were going through the process.
And right.
They're not aware that, because probably of racism, institutionalized racism, immigration laws have become, I mean, I can say this openly because Stephen Miller is the driving force behind the Trump presidency.
Right.
And it's immigration policy. Mm-hmm. And we have seen reports of the man contributing to white supremacist ideas. Mm-hmm. Because of this, immigration laws have become more draconic, more forbidding, a lot more restrictive. So you can't say, well, I immigrated here legally. Those brown people here are breaking the law. Therefore, they are so-and-so or whatever. Honestly, you can't really say that in a country that was founded by revolution and by breaking the law, when an unjust law was being put forward.
Yeah, and also the reality, and this is where I almost kind of see, like, critical race theory is deceptive because there's sometimes you're like, okay, I can see your point here. But remember I said one of my big pet peeves is someone gets the right answer the totally wrong way, and this makes me question my thinking.
Yeah,
because we got to the same place, but I'm like, no, I completely disagree with all your assumptions here. Some Chicano Americans are American solely by, they were on the American side of the Texas border when America annexed it.
Yeah.
From the Spanish. It was just plunk. Entire indigenous tribes were divided across the Mexico-US border. Half of them were American, half of them were Mexican. Yeah. They didn't choose that. And that's that odd sort of forced migration that has a very different narrative to it than the slave trade. But because narrative is so central to critical race theory, you get this mess where I start thinking this is critical race theory is actually not a theory at all. It has become so diluted outside its original application in examining legal systems and critiquing the law. It has had such scope creep. I call it the silly putty effect. You ever play with silly putty?
Yes.
Okay. You know how when you take silly putty and you smush it on newsprint? I like to use Beetle Bailey comics. I don't know why. Beetle Bailey and Blondie, because those simple comics looked funniest when you started tugging the silly putty and creating all these distorted images, right?
Nightmare Blondie.
Yeah, so that's what these postmodern concepts are to me. They started with a very valid idea. You know, the idea that the U.S. justice system needs to be looked at through a critical lens because there's a lot of damn racism and sexism inherent in the U.S. criminal justice system.
Yes.
But it has become so distorted by stretching the silly putty that now, I mean, what eventually happens if you pull the silly putty too far? It distorts, and then it tears.
And then it exists as something beyond recognition of its original form.
Yeah, then it's just a blob, right? And that, to me, is where critical race theory sits. And because, to me, it's that same thing we talk about. If you have a philosophy based simply on narrative, simply on counter narratives, and you get every person has a unique truth within a system, then any opponent can then silly putty that truth to create the exact opposite outcome.
Yes.
And that's why I think you correctly identified that critical race theory has actually been responsible for an uptick in racism. You know, there's a reason that the children of people who lived in the Jim Crow South seem more bitter about it and feel less American than their parents and grandparents who grew up in that system do.
Yeah. And that is one of the problems that you always end up with postmodernism and any theory that is based on postmodernist thought. And then because of the philosophical Kama Sutra that it, I mean, by that, I mean, it distorts itself into very, very flexible positions.
Right.
You are sort of giving your, not only are you kind of rejecting standards to begin with, that there is anything such a thing as a standard to which you can appeal,
right.
But you're also giving your opponent just as much flexibility to change definitions, as you. And in many cases, unfortunately, your opponent, especially if they're sophists, are much more practiced at playing that game.
Well, so, not just are they more practiced, if you believe critical race theory, they are more powerful than you are because they have systemic power. So why are you giving your alleged systemic oppressors more weapons to use against you?
Exactly.
Now, all right. So I think we need to come in for a landing here because we've probably given people plenty of ammunition to silly putty and distort for themselves. But what I want to do, what I always like to do, I don't just like to dump on stuff. You know this, Mouse.
Kaboosh, yes.
Yeah, I like to suggest solutions. And I'll give you the final word. So I'll go first and then we'll sign off and see if this needs a second round or something like that later on. I want to dip my toe in very, very cautiously.
Carefully, yeah.
Because we are dealing with a lot of feelings here, not a lot of thought. But I really believe that blaming systems that were created by people lets the people off the hook for the systems they created.
Yes.
Why is the real estate system in the US? Why is the banking system in the US? Why is the political system in the US racist? Because racist people created them. You don't need to contort systems and get into all this vaguely Marxist, you know, class-based warfare to explain why most systems of power in the US are racist.
Are racist.
They were designed that way deliberately because racists designed them. That is that E equals MC squared version of philosophy. Mm-hmm. You know, I like so much. It's simple. It's clean. It's quick. It makes sense. Left side equals right side. We don't have to get complicated.
Right. It's if you believe something. If you subscribe yourself to a school of beliefs or an ideology, and you truly believe in that, then your actions and the consequences of those actions will reflect that belief. So, of course, it is no surprise that so many institutions have institutionalized racism built into them because they were designed, as you said, by people who truly believed, you know, that
in white superiority.
In white superiority.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, huge portions of the U.S., the current U.S. system were designed during Jim Crow, mm-hmm. when, you know, these businessmen were putting on white pajamas and hoods at night and going on and burning crosses.
Right. And I will acknowledge that Biden tried to address a valid a thing that exists, which
right.
is institutionalized racism. I think her mistake was in how she addressed it. We cannot turn our backs and say institutionalized racism is not a thing, because it is.
Right.
But ultimately, all racism, all isms, really, of that breed of action and thought rest solely on the notion that a person is inferior merely because they're part of a collective, and a collective that you disapprove. Like, one of the things that I really liked when you were doing your introduction to feminism mm-hmm. for gamers is...
That's on my YouTube channel for anybody who wants to watch it.
Yeah. Go watch it because it's really good. But you were dealing with... and you also addressed this, I think, in Lady Bits, mm-hmm. Which is also a really good one. Go watch it, people. It's on our YouTube channel. When you were trying to clear away all of the Baroque frippery that has been built around the notion, the definitions of sexism, and you boiled it down to sexism is the belief that, you know, men are superior to women or women are superior to men.
Well, it was specifically one gender is right. superior to all to other genders.
Other genders,
right.
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly. And racism, at its core, E equals MC squared, it's exactly that.
Yep.
The belief that one race is superior to others. It doesn't matter what your power index is, if it's over 9,000 or whatever.
Right.
It doesn't matter, because we're not talking about role-playing games. We're not talking about anything except the moral dimension, because racism and all of that type of prejudice are beliefs that impact people on the moral dimension and therefore their personal dimension. And it is, we can make as many laws as we want, but if we do not tackle the moral dimension, if we do not dismantle on a cultural level, which means on an individual level.
Right. Because cultures are collections of individuals.
Exactly. Because
right.
cultures are collections of individuals. If we do not dismantle that boogeyman, that notion that it's even remotely acceptable as an argument to say, well, this gender is superior to all others, this race is superior to all others.
Right.
Racism as an institution is not going to change.
That's right, because you're getting the problem with critical race theory is it's pretty much making the same mistakes that the original natural law proponents who justified racism did. They mm-hmm. start with a thing they're trying to prove. And
right.
instead of deducing an outcome, they force the logic and cherry pick and make loopholes and exceptions. We're back to the exception pet peeve. To justify that a priori reasoning, which mm-hmm. is just a fancy way of saying belief. And
yeah.
that's why we can't even right now.
We can't even right now,
right.
definitely. And
I think that's one of the most toxic concepts in philosophy.
It is.
Making belief into reason.
And honestly, and this is it. This is the problem with the Biddle equation, because because it perpetuates these notions. It does not, it gives the individual a license not to examine his or her own beliefs because, well, you know, yeah, that might be kind of prejudice, but I don't have institutionalized power, so it can't be racist. So it's not nearly as bad as, you know, Senator so-and-so who is white and is clearly a gigantic raging racist. So it divorces personal accountability for your beliefs. And It ensues the perpetuation of these racist patterns of thought.
Yes, it certainly does perpetuate the very thing that it's trying to stop. And I did promise I was going to keep this short.
Yes.
So I'm not going to perpetuate the very thing I said I was going to start. I am not going to make an exception for myself. So, Mouse, thank you very much. Thank you for tackling this. If people like it, we'll tackle other difficult subjects related to prejudice and why they just make no sense. Mm-hmm. This podcast has been the Broken Clock Podcast on the FU Network, because thinking is good for you, even when it hurts sometimes. If you like this sort of stuff, if you believe Derrida is the father of all hot takes, and you can't even right now, support us on Patreon, buy some t-shirts, kick us a couple bucks a month, funetwork.tv. Go, all the other podcasts are here, which tackle similar topics from a different perspective. Mouse, I'll leave the last word to you.
Come check us out and keep the clocks ticking, people.
All right, everybody. Thanks for listening. This is a podcast. Listening.
This is fun. The FU Network.